Dr. Robert Bartholomew with us. We're going to take calls with him and continue chatting about some of these incredible true stories behind Hollywood's scariest movies in his book, American Hauntings. Okay, back with Robert Bartholomew. Let's talk about the Amityville Horror, of course, on Long Island in New York. Very famous. The book, the film, and here you go. And then he went really crazy. That's one of the great stories, the great cases, Robert. Fill us in on what you think happened.
Well, what Roswell is to UFOs and Loch Ness is to lake monsters, Amityville is to hauntings. The evidence for the Amityville Horror on the surface is very compelling. It was based on 35 hours of tape recordings with Jay Anson, who did the book, who interviewed George and Kathy Lutz. And this happened between December of 1975 and January of 1976. Well, what they reported was, and it's interesting because the Lutzes passed lie detector tests. They said there was like mysterious knocking noises and they saw shadowy figures. There was a mysterious green slime seeping through keyholes, cloven hoof tracks in the snow. At one point, Kathy levitated 2 feet in the air above her bed. So it's a very scary story. And of course, there's the priest who was blessing the house, and he supposedly heard that voice that said, "Get out." And he said it slapped him in the face. Well, when you start looking at the evidence here, the first oddity that I noticed was all these crazy things are happening. And with the pluck of General Patton and the patience of Gandhi, they stay in the house for 28 days. So that's the first red flag for me. I mean, I'm out of there as soon as I see the fly swarm. I'm gone.
Yeah, goodbye.
The information about the priest is very interesting. The priest later appeared on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, a great program, that he said, indeed, I heard a voice say, "Get out." Now, later, there was a court case about the book, and the priest was called in the late 1970s to testify under oath in the U.S. District Court in Brooklyn, New York. And he said in that case that it didn't exactly happen the way it was described in the book. He said he never saw or heard anything unusual. He said he felt a very dark presence that possibly was the presence of evil. But he never heard a voice tell him to get out. He said he had a feeling that something was telling him to get out, but he never actually heard the voice. Now, remember, that had been the scene of a mass murder. That's why they got the priest to go and bless the house. So in the court case, that would seem to discredit the Amityville Horror, what really happened. You have former neighbors, James Mullally and his wife. They said they visited the Lutzes 2 weeks after they'd moved into the house, when the demons were supposedly still in full riot. And they said everything seemed fine. There was nothing unusual at all. But if you look at the book and in the movie, you know, crazy things are happening. There's an interesting incident with the wrinkled face. One night about 2 a.m., Kathy's face is, she looks in the mirror and her face is all wrinkled and shriveled up. And she said she looked like a 90-year-old
yeah,
woman.
Yeah, it's like instant aging.
Think about it. Now, if that happened to you, and that's your wife, I would be going to the emergency room, or at the very least, I'm taking a photo.
Right. You think she's got Bell's palsy or something like that.
What they did was they held each other in bed until about 8 a.m., and then she returned to normal. So, you know, that's a red flag there. And then there's the report of Kathy's levitation. George Lutz claimed that Kathy levitated 2 feet off her bed while she was sleeping. In September of 1979, George testified in a U.S. federal court with a lawsuit going on involving the story, and he said that the levitation had been exaggerated. He said instead of 2 feet, it was 2 inches in the air. But if you go back
to... Well, that's still pretty good.
Well, if you go back to 1977... there was a newspaper article It was one of the New York newspapers that interviewed George about the case before it became famous and was published as a book. And George gave in that interview, he said that Kathy had slid across the bed while asleep as if by levitation, but he said she hadn't actually levitated. So what I'm getting here are direct quotes from George Lutz about the same incident, but I'm getting three different stories.
Go ahead, Robert.
The other thing that's interesting is the green slime. You know, it reminds me of Ghostbusters. One day, he's in the house, and he finds this green goo oozing from the ceiling. It's coming out of keyholes.
Dropping, yeah.
That's right. What does he do? He puts his finger on it and tastes it like a drug detective would in a movie.
Not smart. Not smart.
Well, George, how many people do you know who would move into a new house, spot green goo dripping from the ceiling or from a keyhole,
and taste
put
it
in their mouth?
Yeah, I'd smell it. I wouldn't taste it.
Yeah, so these things are red flags to me. And the one that really seals it for me is the weather. In the book, Jay Anson writes a number of incidents, and they tell about the weather on this particular day. And I'm looking here at the book. At 3:15 a.m. on Christmas morning in 1975, he describes winter moonlight flooding the bedroom. Well, in reality, if you look at the weather conditions for Amityville, it was cloudy. And there's a number of cases like this where it's just completely different from the actual weather of the time. And there's an astronomical one as well where George Lutz says that at 3:15 a.m. on Christmas morning, he looked at his daughter's window and saw a pig's face staring back. That was one of the scariest parts of the film for me. At the time, he said the orb of the full moon was like a flashlight lighting his way. Well, the moon was in its third quarter, and it had set several hours earlier, so that was physically impossible.
Hmm. So you concluded what?
I conclude that there was a haunting. The real haunting was the poor people that lived in the house after the killing, because they had people running up at all hours of the night, digging up chunks of their lawn and running away, going up, taking pictures inside the window, to the point where they were haunted by these real people and tourists, to the point where they had to sell the house and get out. I believe the Amityville Horror very clearly was a hoax.
All right. Well, it's good that we got that part of it. We're going to come back with more of these, but let's go and take some calls. Let's go to Mark in Quebec, in Montreal, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good morning, George.
Morning.
Yes. Hey, George, I hope you come to Montreal one day.
I'd love to do a show there.
You have nice places here, you know. What I want to say is one movie that bothers me as much as The Exorcist when I look at it, it's The Entity. It's a woman that lives with her two children in California, and she gets beaten up by a spirit in her room and all that. And I just wonder if anything of that was true.
That's a scary case, too. I don't know if you looked at that, Robert, or if it was strictly all Hollywood.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in staying within yourself. I looked at these seven cases, and those are the cases I'm an expert on. I'm not an expert on the case of The Entity. I simply don't know.
And we don't know if that's strictly all Hollywood. It could have been just a created script, right?
That's right. I mean, one of the lessons from our book is that what you're seeing in the film is mostly Hollywood anyway, with some based on the alleged real case, but most of it is Hollywood.
Of course, The Entity was based on a book by Frank Di Folletta.
So what's the old saying? If you don't know your history well, then you're forced to rely on Hollywood to get it with these. And that's the thing. They're based on a true story films, but they're not completely based on a true story, because there's a lot of stuff in those films that clearly wasn't in the original case.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's go to first-time caller Mike, driving a front-end loader in North Dakota. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
How you doing? I appreciate you taking the call.
Sure thing, sir.
I found your station on accident about 2-3 weeks ago and listened to it every morning or every night.
Beautiful. I'm glad you got us.
Well, a quick thing that I had happened to me, I've been over here for about 5 years. I work about 9 months out of the year. I'm away from my family. They're 1,400 miles away. And I was talking to my wife, and you know, I was kind of feeling guilty about being over here. And I was very close to my grandfather. He passed away 30 years ago. And we talked about it, and she's like, well, you never know. He might be your guardian angel. And just, you know, pray about it and you know, think about what he would say. The next day, in my loader, in a machine, out of the blue, middle of the day, I could smell him. And my grandfather, I've never smelled it since he passed away, and I haven't smelled it after, but we would work together a lot, cutting wood, hiking, you name it. And it might sound strange, but he had a distinctive smell when he'd get, you know, sweating and working. And I had that smell, and it kind of freaked me out at first. I'd never heard of, you know, I've heard of people, their mind playing games and seeing something, but a smell, I'd never run across that before. Have you ever heard of that?
Some people pick up the smell of perfume of granny or something like that. Robert, I'll let you chime in here.
Well, I do know that studies have been done that show that smell is the one sense that's most closely tied to memory.
Explain.
Well, if you smell a smell that is most closely tied to triggering other memories that you've had in the past. So there may be some type of, you know, as a scientist, I would say I would look for some type of psychological explanation for that, as opposed to maybe it was the presence of your grandfather. But who am I to say?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Let's go to Maribai in Sacramento, California. Maribai, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, George. I have to challenge your guest a little bit.
Go ahead.
I understand what he's saying, but for people like me, but for people like you, George, who have had so many experiences, then I just want to know what qualifies as expert in psychology, because they always do that, and it goes against what people are seeing. And the caller just talked about the smell. We were sitting there. My brother was supposed to die within 24 hours, and there were three of us in the room. This is something I just thought of from the previous caller. All of a sudden, all of us yelled. There were three of us sitting there. My brother was back in the room dying, and we had taken a break. And the smell came through so strong, mm-hmm. of flowers. Everyone was like, whoa! You know, what's that? Everyone smelled it and jumped. And he died like right after that.
Sorry to hear that.
You know, there are smells. We know in my family, when you smell daddy's tobacco, when you smell two mamas, well, my grandmother's lilac perfume, she always used, somebody dies.
A lot of people that pick that up, but they, you know, they have Robert chime in here on your question. You know, he doesn't claim to know it all for sure, but Robert, go ahead.
Well, look, I'm on her side. I'm not claiming that, but I'm, as a scientist, I have to look for scientific explanations as opposed to things that haven't been proven yet by science. But I'm not saying that what you experienced, certainly you experienced that, I believe that. I simply don't know what it is, and I'll leave it there. I'm not claiming that I can explain all these cases, but I looked at these seven so-called best cases, and I'm very familiar with those cases, and I feel comfortable talking about them. But I'm not debating you or denying you whatsoever. I'm on your side. I don't know.
Robert, thousands of paranormal groups keep popping up all over this planet trying to do ghost hunting and the like. Some are very good. Some are very amateurish. Does it hurt or help?
Well, that's a great question. I view these groups often, you know, you get, whether it's UFOs, whether it's Bigfoot or the paranormal and the supernatural, you get a lot of infighting within groups and between groups. And that's really unfortunate. And I think it can also, when I was talking to Brad Steiger maybe a year or so ago, and he agreed with me, I said, some of these shows on TV, and there's been that promotes these groups out there, they vary so much in their approach. You have to be really careful. I mean, you'll see somebody, they go into a house, and there's a 2-degree surge in temperature in the corner of the room, and there's a fly swarm in the window, and they conclude that there's a spirit there, or they hear a noise. So, look, I'm for people investigating, but at the same time, we have to have some methods as we do this, other than feelings and, okay, so there's some energy field in the house. Does that mean it's proof of life after death? I don't think so. I mean, there's all kinds of energies out there that are natural phenomena.
How do you explain, Robert, demons in all this? Because I believe they truly exist.
Well, like the Amityville Horror and these other cases, there's the three possibilities that, yes, and I hold open the possibility, although I think it's highly improbable, that there could actually be people who are possessed by the devil. But as a scientist, I go for the explanation that these people are experiencing a psychiatric condition.
Yeah.
And very clearly, there are people around the world who, when they go into a trance state and there's dogs in their tribe, they start barking like a dog, or they start meowing like a cat. And it's the same in different cultures. If you have a belief in Christianity, that the possession state is going to reflect what you believe in. That's why the church doesn't accept every possession case. So clearly there's a psychiatric, psychological phenomena called possession. People dissociate and go into trance states. Is there another state as well where people can be possessed by demons? Well, that's for other people to decide.
Robert, where do we get this book, American Hauntings?
It should be in bookstores across America. I'm very happy that it's with a major publisher. I think they're the number one publisher for high school textbooks in the country.
That's exciting stuff. And are you on Facebook and Twitter?
I don't even have a mobile phone.
What? What?
All my kids do, but I don't. I'm not too much into the technology age.
How have you gotten by without all this?
Well, I mean, I'm very much into email, but I'm not a Facebook person. I check my Facebook probably once every 2 weeks. My kids are into that stuff. My kids have mobile phones, so if we break down the side of the road, they'll save me.
That's good. Robert, we're going to come back and take some final calls. Plus, I want to talk about the Bell Witch case, too. Well, it's that time of year again, Ghost to Ghost. The show will be Friday, October 30th. So send us your ghost stories. Email them to us, if you would, at ghoststory@coasttocoastam.com. ghoststory@coasttocoastam.com. And make sure you include your day and evening phone numbers in that. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. The Bell Witch case, of course, one of the oldest and most famous in U.S. history, had to happen back in the 1800s about an individual by the name of Bell, who ended up getting murdered, or something horrible happened to him. While he was talking about so many strange things that happened, they had the music there pretty loud in the movie. Robert, take it away. Tell us about the Bell Witch.
It was about 1817. There were a series of strange happenings reported on the Bell Farmstead near Adams, Tennessee. That's in Middle Tennessee. And they had poltergeist activity. This invisible force would touch family members, slap them, pinch them. Stones would suddenly appear out of nowhere and fly through the air. Furniture would collapse. And there was a disembodied voice. According to the story, a local witch named Katie Batts felt cheated by John Bell in a land deal. And after she died, her spirit haunted the Bells. How do we know this happened? Well, John Bell's son Richard wrote a diary describing the haunting. And before he died, he gave it to this local newspaper editor, Martin Ingram, who then wrote it into a book that was famously published in the 1890s on the Bell Witch. So we can say with virtual certainty now that the case of the Bell Witch has been solved. We have solved it in our book because the claims just don't add up. And, you know, this is a real collaboration here because there's an American language professor named Jesse Glass, and he spent the last 25 years going through every microfilm reel at the Tennessee State Archives in Clarksville up to when Ingram's book was published. And in the book, it claims that the case was in the diary as well. It claims it was in all the papers at the time. People came from hundreds of miles around to witness it. Well, according to Jesse Glass, who did this research, there's not a single newspaper article that mentions anything about the Bell Witch up until the time when the book came out. And a handwriting analysis shows that the diary of Bell's son was actually written by Ingram, and perhaps with a couple other reporters as well, because what Glass uncovered was that key elements of the Bell Witch story had previously appeared in the newspapers as fictional writings, newspapers that were operated by Ingram, and the writers were reporters for him. So it's very clear to me, thanks to Jesse Glass, that this case can now be solved. And for me, we can move on and look at more interesting cases, because there's a lot of interesting cases out there, and we don't get bogged down looking in the past for these cases that were, it's clearly a hoax.
Okay, so of all the cases we've looked at so far, you think The Conjuring may have been the case?
Well, the case in which they were telling the truth. But the interesting thing is, in that case, their phone would float through the air on several occasions. You know, it was a cord phone. The fridge would occasionally open up and expel food onto the floor. Cindy's bed would rise up and float on several occasions. And a broom would sweep by itself on several occasions. Here's the question I have. I have no doubt that those people are sincere in describing those things. But how come this happened over 10 years? How come no one ever took a video or a photo of these things happening? And keeping in mind, this is a family that had, it seemed to have a lot of different unusual psychological phenomena running through it, like these waking dreams, imaginary companions, things like this. So I am sympathetically skeptical. I believe in what they're saying, but I'm cautious that it's actually proof of a haunting.
All right, let's go and wrap things up here with the final calls. We will go to South Bend, Indiana. Hunter's with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Hunter.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I was just going to tell you that my family has experienced a ghost. My grandfather, he died when I was between 5 and 6 years old. And, I mean, I remember bits and pieces of him, but I really didn't know him. But through my family, I guess he was really big with the grandchildren. Well, now, since he's died, every time one of the grandchildren would walk into my grandmother's living room where his rocking chair sat, the chair will start rocking on its own, and everybody in the room can start smelling his pipe tobacco.
I love, see, there are signs. Robert, let me ask you this specifically. Do you believe the other side exists? Life after death?
I want to believe. I'm sympathetically skeptical. I mean, I was raised a Catholic. This is a very emotional topic. You know, outside of the 7 cases I have looked at with my co-author, who am I to deny what this man has said? Who am I to deny that that was not the presence of someone who he had lost? But keeping in mind, this is a very emotional topic, and there's a tremendous will, I think, out there to believe, and I want to believe. So we have to try to keep it in perspective as well.
Well, there's no doubt about that. But when, you know, people actually can smell his tobacco or granny's perfume or something like that, either they can manifest this with such incredible power in their brains, as you were hinting about, or something else is going on.
That's right. And, you know, I'm not a debunker. I do not deny that strange things happen. I've had it happen to me. What we've done is to evaluate the world's seven best cases, so to speak, that the experts, parapsychologists, writers, researchers, have argued are the very best cases, and we have assessed those cases. This other phenomenon is very interesting about the smells. That's something that I would be interested in looking into, because I think there's several callers have said the same thing.
Let's go to another call in South Bend, Indiana. Michael's turn on the wild card line. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
You know, actually, I think the caller before me kind of solidified my my belief in this. I think that if you ever talk to anybody that has absolutely no beliefs or anything with the supernatural, people that just completely omit it from their beliefs wholeheartedly, they will shoot holes in your theories and everything, and they won't have anything to do with it. But the people, you know, like us, who have some sort of interest in the field, they tend to believe it. And the people that believe it are the ones that experience it, right? So I think that what we believe is what we see and is what we experience. I think that we create our own reality.
Where do you think the smell of, like, tobacco comes from?
Oh, the smell of tobacco?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
The last caller.
I mean,
he's talking about his grandfather and his tobacco smell. How did they manifest that, Robert?
From a scientific perspective, is there some type of psychological phenomena where you can actually, the mind can create that? I mean, the mind is a very mysterious thing.
Can the mind create a smell?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Terry's with us, Cleveland, Ohio, first-time caller. Hello, Terry, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I want to put it out there that I truly believe there is some type of life after death. I have a story I want to share with you.
All right.
2002, a situation happened in the morning where things went bad that morning for me. It was little simple little things like going on with my car. And I had a really rough day. However, I don't know if you know about the boat, a beautiful soap opera. Here in Cleveland, it's been coming on for over 20 years for like at 1:30. 1:30 in the afternoon. And I'm sorry, I'm hiding in the bathroom.
Oh, okay. We're getting a little feedback from you.
Sorry about that. Yes. However, I'm sitting there watching the Bold and Beautiful at 1:30 p.m., and a strange pain went through my heart. Never felt it before. I grabbed my chest. It was so sharp. However, it went away so quick, I didn't think about it no more. But I did go take a nap. When I took this nap, I was dreaming. And the dream is something I really can't share with you, but it was a healthy dream. And on top of having this dream, a man just appeared in my dream. He had nothing to do with this dream. He had a black hat on, and he had a long black trench coat on, and he said something happened to my brother. And I didn't believe him. I said, oh, okay, you know. I just threw it off, and next thing I know, I was hearing a knock on my door waking me up out of my sleep. And my kids told me it was my aunt. As I walked down those stairs, she told me my brother got killed.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Yes, and you know what? I was so devastated because he was my only sibling that I went through a lot of things with his trial, getting paperwork on what happened. And you know what happened? The thing is, he got shot at 1:30 something.
See, but I'm a believer that in your dreams you have incredible supernatural abilities, precognitive dreams. You had that ability. For some reason, you had that ability. I would call it somewhat paranormal, Robert, wouldn't you?
Phenomena that you can't replicate in a laboratory, and that's the problem. It's sporadic. Is it, you know, people have dreams. Is it one in a million or one in 10 million that something like that happens and it just happens to be a coincidence? You know, you have to remember when the space shuttle blew up in 1986, NASA had received dozens of letters predicting it would explode. But the thing is, when the Titanic sunk, the shipping company had received a lot of letters predicting it was going to sink, and several of them on the maiden voyage. But when the Apollo 11 astronauts went up as well to the moon, they had received the same letters predicting disaster. So is this one of those 1 in 50 million cases where somebody had this premonition or dream and it actually came true?
Right.
Statistically, you know, statistically it's improbable, but from a scientific perspective, that's what I would be looking at. But who am I to say? It's a fascinating case.
You devote a chapter to Steven Spielberg's film, The Poltergeist, and you talk about what his inspiration was. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, that's a funny story. You know, a lot of these poltergeist cases and hauntings are quite scary. This is the Pop or the Poltergeist case. It involved a bottle tops that would pop all over this house on the James Herman family in Seaford, Long Island. The interesting thing is, this house was just 5 miles from the Amityville house. And this happened in 1958, the famous Seaford case. This is probably the most famous poltergeist case in American history that no one can remember. But at the time, Popper the Poltergeist was a household name in America. It was on the front page of the New York Times. It had a huge spread in Life magazine. Many famous people visited the house and did interviews, like the journalist Edward R. Murrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the first known case that was scientifically investigated by the Duke University Parapsychology Lab. And they concluded in the end that they couldn't explain it. They said it wasn't any deception they could tell. And they concluded that it was some type of real phenomena that apparently followed this little Jimmy Herman around the house. I'm more skeptical, because if you look at the facts in the case, every one of the 67 incidents in the house that happened, little Jimmy was nearby. And whenever he stayed with relatives or was at school, the poltergeist was quiet. And Popper never operated between the hours of 1 and 6 a.m. That just so happened to be the time that Jimmy was asleep. So, and there was a parapsychologist who investigated that also concluded that Jimmy was the poltergeist. So we have to be careful with this case and not get too emotionally attached to the people. They even had a detective. The Nassau County actually devoted one of their detectives to investigate the case full time. And the detective concluded that there was really something going on. But to me, what tells the tale is what happened. The police decided to put this fluorescent dust on some of the items that had been disturbed by the poltergeist. And they were disturbed over and over again. And it was an ingenious plan, but the detective actually told the family of the plan ahead of time, even to point out which items and which bottles were they were putting the dust on, and cautioned them not to touch the items.
Yeah.
So here's a case where someone was so believing that they compromised the case.
Let's go to Joe in Canyon Lake, California, west of the Rockies. Joe, go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you, George. Sure. Thank you, Robert, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I love the show. Good conversation. I want to preface this by saying I'm a very logical, rational, and skeptical person. About a year ago, I started having issues with my personality, to where it appeared that I apologize. I'm a little bit nervous first.
That's okay. And I've only got like a minute, so
okay, no worries,
do the
no
best
worries.
You can.
So what wound up happening was my personality started changing, and it was almost like a demon possession.
Whoa. Possessed, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and again, that was something I normally don't believe in. But for example, I would tell people I'm Lucifer, and I would take tables, like 300-pound tables, and throw them. I'd wake up screaming. It felt like there was always pressure on me.
Did you feel like you were Lucifer?
I didn't feel like I was Lucifer, but I told people, you know, that I was Lucifer, and I would pick up objects that were like 300 to 500 pounds and throw them like they were a feather.
Jeez. That's unbelievable. You do get strange strength after a while. Robert, we are out of time, my friend. Good luck with your work. And what else are you working on?
Well, I've got a book on A Colorful History of Popular Delusions, which is like a field guide.
I love that.
Fads, crazes, mass hysteria, social panics, riots. That's coming out next month.
Okay, well, let's keep in touch. Let's get you back on again. I love your work, and this one is called American Hauntings, and some of those movie clips, I'm not going to be able to get to sleep tonight. For Dan Galante, David Hines, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.